Hello and welcome in.
First Science.
Because he shows them the magic and mystery of science in everyday living.
On Science Mixtape on Soho Radio. Well, good morning. You're listening to Science Mixtape on Soho Radio. And to celebrate the most hallowed of evenings coming up, we're bringing you a show all about
death.
That's right. We are going to be asking, what is death? How has science redefined it? What happens to you after you die? And is there such a thing as the living dead or zombies? Joining me today to share his expertise is Dr. Jamie Upton, a cell biologist and, more importantly, founder of Art Necro, a collaboration between artists and scientists who study different aspects of death. Good morning, Jamie.
Good morning.
Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
You describe yourself as a death enthusiast. Tell me a bit more about that.
Yeah, it's a worrying title, isn't it? I am interested in death, I guess, because a lot of how we think about death is tied up in all kinds of mythology and traditions that we often sort of take at face value. So with Art Necro, what I was sort of hoping to do was take these deeply ingrained sort of cultural things that we have and try and get to the kernel of like the science at the heart of the things that we think about death. And then from there, maybe try to sort of redefine like new ideas within culture about death. It's like, it's a bold idea, but I feel I'm just the man to do it.
Yeah, it is so fascinating because, like you said, there's so much ancient mythology around it, and it's kind of mystified us for years. And, you know, is there life after death? And even with forensics, like looking at exactly what happens is helping us to be able to date bodies. And
Yeah, and I mean, just generally, I suppose death now has sort of been adopted into newer cultures. Like, I'm basically trying to reclaim death from the goths. I don't see why goths get to have all the fun. It should just be for everyone. We should all get involved with death.
And what was the kind of, how does Art Necro work?
So it's sort of based on a similar model to, so we worked on a project a few years ago called Art Neuro, where we got lots of neuroscientists and paired them up with artists. And we got them to work together for several months, and then we had a big exhibition of everything that they worked on. So we wanted to do something similar, so we rotated the U in Neuro through 90 degrees to create Art Necro. and then, yeah, we've been working with various scientists from all kinds of backgrounds, from psychologists to taphonomists, who are people who look at bodies rotting and skeletons and that sort of thing, to pathologists and cell biologists. And yeah, there's a whole range of different ways that you can look at death from a scientific angle, basically.
Which we will be doing throughout the show. Mm. I'd like to add that I've insisted we all dress up for our Halloween special. So if you want to head over to Twitter, you can see us sporting some particularly fantastic masks here in the studio.
Very well thought out. Outfits, yeah.
No expense has been spared. And our experiment this week, if you want to take part, it is particularly exciting because we are going to be making some toxic cocktails. So if you want to join in at home, you're going to need quite a few ingredients. We're going to make two cocktails. One of them involves amaretto, brandy, lemon juice, grapefruit juice and bitters. And the other involves Calvados, which I've just been informed is an apple brandy.
That's correct.
Bison grass vodka, pineapple juice, cinnamon and rhubarb bitters.
Mm-hmm.
Sounding delicious.
Yeah.
And of course, we want to hear from you as well. So we've got our weekly brain teaser. It is, I have no life, but I can die. What am I? A poetic one for you this week. And appropriately death themed. If you think you know the answer, you can tweet us at Science Mixtape or at Soho Radio. And we'll be reading out your thoughts later in the show. But now, what is your first song and why?
Oh, what is my first song?
Oh, I can tell you, your first song is Back from the Dead by King Harrison. Yeah. Why have you chosen it?
Well, it's about death. There's going to be some gratuitous and slightly tenuous links to death through all my songs. And it's a good funky tune. So it's sort of got a voodoo-y aspect to it. I just like it, to be honest.
Take out the spell on you! Fire! Rigor mortis, a stiffening of the body, sets in between 3 and 4 hours after death. It's caused by chemical changes in the muscles that force them to contract. Rigor mortis disappears again within 36 hours.
Until Yaz found that fact, I didn't even realise that rigor mortis left again. I thought that once you were stiff, you stayed stiff. But I guess maybe the proteins get broken down, so then
you
your muscles...
quite floppy after a while.
So sinister. So that leads us nicely on to... what is death? Like, how do we define death when we're talking about things dying? I looked up a couple of definitions, and there's some different ones. So the permanent ending of vital processes in a cell or tissue sounds pretty good. The end of a life of a person of organism, or just the state of being dead. And it is, it's a state, isn't it?
Yeah. I'm a cell biologist by background, so I'm quite interested by what you say there, death in cell or tissue, because not all of our cells and tissues die at the same time, and it's when certain tissues or organs start to fail that these different stages of death come into play.
Yeah, because I think there's people talk about death like you're alive and then you die, as if it's like an on-off switch.
Yeah.
But someone described it as being like a whole body stroke in which your heart stops beating and then different organs die depending on sort of like how much energy they require and how much oxygen they require. So your brain will go really early on, but your kidneys are take a much longer time to die than your brain.
Yeah, so a lot of what I did in the lab was take cells from, usually not people who died, but removed tissue from people's bodies, with their permission, of course. And then you can put them into a Petri dish with the right balance of sugars and proteins, and you can keep those cells going, like, potentially for years and years if you do the right things to them, if you treat them nice. And in fact, like, one of the best ways to think about what death is and what life is the example of Henrietta Lacks.
So, oh, yes.
Yeah, so this was a woman who, in 1951, went into a hospital in Baltimore complaining of feeling what she called a knot in her womb. And they thought it was something to do with pregnancy, and it turns out she was pregnant, but they later found out that she had cervical cancer, and the doctors did something quite unethical, and they took some samples from her cervix without her knowing, and this, because her cervix had these cancerous cells.
It was particularly aggressive kind of cancer,
yeah,
wasn't it?
Yeah, it was like, but quite effective from a life point of view, because these cells, which they took away and did the same sort of things that I do in Petri dishes, they were able to keep these cells going for, well, they're still going now, and in fact, her cells, which are now known as HeLa cells for Henrietta Lacks, are used in just about every laboratory in the world. They're like a really useful resource.
So she's kind of been immortalized.
Exactly. And that's the exact phrase that we use in cell biology. We call it immortalization. This process of cells basically losing the ability to grow old or die. It sort of, it raises quite interesting philosophical questions, I think, about, you know, what is life, and I suppose the flip side of that, what is death?
Because she as the person has gone.
Yeah.
But if you've got her cells, you've got something of her, but no one would say she was alive.
No.
And yet, is it when you lose your brain, or is it when you lose your body? Because this is what I think is fascinating, is we started, the term brain dead didn't get invented until the late 1960s, when we started to have, like, medical machines that could keep your body breathing, keep your heart beating, keep your body alive. And there was a particular story that I read recently about a 22-year-old in Nebraska who was pregnant, and she suffered a massive brain bleed, and the doctors couldn't save her. And so she became brain dead. But in the process of trying to save her, they'd put her on all these life support machines, and her fetus was still alive. So they kept her body alive long enough for the fetus to be alive, and it's like, is she dead?
Well, in a way, her body is then being used as a life support machine of its own.
Yeah.
That's fascinating and grim, all in one package.
And you've got also like incredible stories of people being technically brought back from the dead.
But again, I suppose that depends on what the definition of their death was in the first instance.
So the story that particularly amazed me was hearing about someone who'd fallen into an icy river, like in the mountains, and was underwater for 45 minutes.
Wow.
Which is, you've drowned by anyone's imagination.
Yeah.
But they pulled her out and they resuscitated, like they were doing kind of CPR, and they took her to hospital. And basically what had happened was, because the water was so cold, her body had just shut down.
Yeah.
And so her brain hadn't suffered any brain damage, yeah, because the cells had just kind of been frozen.
Gone into sort of suspended animation.
Yeah, exactly. So they didn't need any energy. They didn't need any oxygen. And yet, yeah, once they warmed her body back up and started her heart again,
yeah,
they could kind of come back to life.
So, yeah, I mean, when we take cells in the lab and we want to, well, we want to go on our holidays or something, we will do a similar thing. We freeze them down and stick them in minus 80 or even colder into liquid nitrogen.
Ooh.
But the rate that you freeze the cells at is really critical. Because,
like how fast or slow you cool them down?
Yeah, so one of the things that you have to be really careful of when you freeze cells is, if you freeze them normally, then you get water crystals forming.
Mm.
And because 90% of our cells are made of water, these crystals can damage all the proteins. And
they can like burst through membranes and stuff,
exactly,
can't they?
Yeah, so you have to add certain chemicals to the cells before you freeze them down so that they freeze at just the right rate. And the ice that forms is a sort of glassier form of ice rather than a more crystalline form of ice. And that allows you to then get those cells back out of the freezer and can still live easily enough.
Yeah, and I guess people talk about freezing their eggs. So actually, when you think about, yeah, it, we've talked about this a long time, but maybe not in my head like that. Freezing eggs and someone's whole body being frozen, I didn't kind of think of as the same thing.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, it's because it's exponentially harder to freeze down
An entire complicated organism.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard enough to freeze down like a piece of skin tissue, say, and then bring it back from the dead or from the freezer. So yeah, like if you're talking something, you know, the brain is technically the most complicated thing in the universe that we know of, so freezing that down at the right rate is quite a tricky process.
Mm. But they apparently are trialing this in hospitals, cooling down the body during operations,
just throwing people into rivers. So, all right, mate, just kick them off the bridge
just to buy them more time. Yeah. So that in an operation with, yeah, like stab wound victims and stuff, mm, who have like are losing a lot of blood.
Stab someone and throw them off a bridge. Great stuff.
That's the new form of medicine. On to your second song. What are we having next?
So after that funky start, I've gone for a more traditionally sad song about death. So this is by Sufjan Stevens. It's from his really nice album last year, Carolyn Lowell, which was all about his mum who died of cancer. And just about every song on the album is like heartbreakingly lovely, but this one is particularly nice.
Do I care if I despise this? Nothing else matters, I know. In a veil of great disguises, how do I live with your ghost? Should I dare my eyes out now? Everything I see returns to you somehow. Should I tear my heart out now? Everything I feel returns to you somehow.
Forensic scientists can tell roughly how long it has been since death by looking at the species of insect on the body.
Ew.
Mm.
Now, we are getting ready for our toxicology experiment. Jamie, I think you're probably my favourite guest so far for making it scientifically valid that we make cocktails on the show at 10 a.m. on a Saturday morning.
Look. I think the best experiment you can do is experimenting with alcoholism and disguising it as some kind of
as legit
cocktail connoisseurism. Yeah. Like, oh no, like it's fine drinking at 10 in the morning.
And so just to spell it out, the valid scientific reason why we are doing this is that everything going into these cocktails is potentially toxic.
Yep.
And so Jamie's going to talk us through this. So if I do the mixing, do you want to explain which,
yeah,
about each ingredient?
I'm going to take this mask off because I can't speak.
That's okay.
Right. There we go. I'll put it on my head.
Okay. So
we're going to start off with this one, which is called the scented bitter almonds.
Ooh, why is it called that?
So cyanide has the same smell as almonds or amaretto. Weirdly though, yeah, it's delicious. Works for radio.
Who'd have thought poison could smell so good?
Well, they're quite similar shaped chemicals, basically. And in fact, amaretto is made from apricot kernels.
Mm-hmm.
It's not made from almonds, usually. And apricot kernels have got really high concentrations of cyanide in them. In fact, if you were to eat, I think it's about 110 grams of apricot kernels, you would consume enough cyanide to kill you.
Whoa.
Generally, health food stores only sell them in bags of about 30 grams, so you're fine. But there was a story.
Oh my God, so they actually, you actually can buy them in health food stores?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, I thought you would like be at, like having to break into the apricot stone yourself yeah, to get them out.
What a great weekend that would be. Yeah, so...
So how much of this do I want?
This, you want to put about 60 mil.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good strong start to the cocktails. This is my amaretto going in.
We'll do two parts of that to one part juice. So the juice is half lemon juice and half grapefruit juice. Yeah, lovely stuff. Maybe a little bit more, actually. So citric acid is actually quite toxic. I think it's something like 5 grams per kilo of body weight is enough to kill you. And also, grapefruit juice has got a chemical called naringin in it, which inhibits a group of enzymes in your gut and liver called the cytochrome P enzymes. Uh-huh. And these are the enzymes that are involved in breaking down drugs, everything from beta blockers to cocaine or ecstasy. So if you are drinking grapefruit juice, you have to be quite careful with what drugs you're taking as well. So
I've seen this on like medical labels, contraindication or something.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
You shouldn't take this, don't drink grapefruit juice if you're taking this. And I just thought that was a weird one. I was like, how can grapefruit juice
hurt you? Well, that's because of the naringin, yeah. Ah. Or like conscientious dealers always sort of will warn you off drinking too much grapefruit juice. And then finally, so this one isn't actually toxic. This is Peychaud's bitter, made from the Peychaud's fruit. I've no idea. Oh.
It's got a nice red colour though, it's like we're adding blood.
There you go. So have a taste of that.
Ooh, okay. Mmm. That's delicious. I'm really getting the amaretto flavour.
That'll be the amaretto. yeah, it's super sweet. I like that one though. Have a drink, Yaz.
Yeah, it's really nice.
So the second cocktail that we're gonna make is called Poison Apple.
Oh, and sorry, just before you start this, I want to say to our listeners, so you're hearing, as Jamie puts in the ingredients, you're hearing kind of how they're toxic and why. At the end of this, we want you to guess which cocktail is the more toxic of the two. So remember, you can tweet us at Science Mixtape.
Yes. Okay, so this one contains, well, put a bit of cinnamon in first. So cinnamon contains something called coumarin, which is converted into a substance in our liver which is actually quite similar to warfarin, which is used to thin your blood if you've got high blood pressure. It's also used as rat poison.
Oh my God, so there's something in cinnamon that's used in rat poison.
Well, it's an analog, so it's a similar chemical, but rats and mice actually convert cinnamon into this more dangerous substance more readily than humans do. So
like the way they process it in their body
their liver. Yeah, exactly. So if you want to kill mice and rats, why not
just leave out some cinnamon, cover your cheese in cinnamon.
Some Cinnabons. I'm just adding some bison grass vodka as well.
Now, it has to be the bison grass. It can't just be any vodka, can it?
Oh, no. So it contains coumarin as well in the bison grass. So we're just topping up your coumarin.
We've got a double dose of coumarin.
Yeah, we're just like...
If I was a rat and I had that cocktail now, I'd die, right?
Oh, you'd have an absolutely lovely time before you died, though. It's delicious. Right, so
I wonder how much it takes to get a rat drunk.
Oh, that's an experiment for another day. So we're also adding some pineapple juice.
And why pineapple juice?
So pineapples contain an enzyme called bromelain, which is an enzyme that breaks down proteins. And in fact, you might have experienced this if you've ever eaten the wrong parts of a pineapple. So if you eat the core, or you eat the sort of bits at the edge, or you eat a pineapple that hasn't ripened properly,
mm-hmm.
you'll get like your mouth will start to swell up a bit, or like
you feel like you've got a fuzzy tongue. Yeah.
Exactly, yeah. So what that is enzymes breaking down your cells.
Breaking down the cells in your tongue?
Yeah, basically. They're sort of, it's quite vicious stuff.
Pineapple was so deadly.
Yeah. Do you ever see a pineapple that could take a bite out of you? So, yeah, pineapple farmers will quite often find that their fingerprints start to digest. Oh, do you want to open that? Thank you. Yeah, so pineapple farmers, like, don't have fingerprints.
Oh my god, because the kind of ridges and furrows are being taken away.
Exactly,
by
yeah, which is why you get the classic.
So they'd be great murderers.
Exactly, yeah, the classic adage that pineapple farmers make the best murderers.
That's where that saying comes from.
Yeah, yeah. Like everyone always wonders, don't they? You just take it as writ. So finally, we're adding some rhubarb bitters. So rhubarb leaves, as you might know, are quite toxic. Yeah, that's why you've never, hopefully never eaten any rhubarb leaves. But they contain a chemical called oxalic acid, which is incredibly corrosive organic acid that can basically just melt through your body.
How many leaves would you have to eat for them to do that?
That's a good question. Like, I would say
you'd be okay with one, but just don't have a whole meal of them?
I would just eat none of them.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, just stick to eating the nice, delicious red bit. Although in the First World War, when they were sort of trying to ration things, they advised that people use rhubarb leaves instead of if they couldn't get their hands on lettuce leaves or anything. So reportedly, there were a few deaths during the war from people who got oxalic acid poisoning from rhubarb leaves.
Yeah, because I guess it's so counterintuitive. If you're eating one part of the plant, you wouldn't think the other part was going to be poisonous.
Exactly. It's the same thing with the pineapple. The core of the pineapple is way more toxic than the outer sort of rings. It's like the puffer fish. You've got to cut out the healthy bits and not eat the poisonous bits. Yeah. So, do you want to have a taste of this one?
Yeah, does this one have a name?
We just call this one Poison Apple.
Poison Apple. Okay, yeah. I'm going for it. It's kind of like having an apple pie with a kick of vodka.
Well, there you go.
Really,
do you want to try that, Yaz?
Yeah, sure. Wow, that's really good. Really delicious poison.
Yeah, I do love that. It's like, what's your poison? Because I guess alcohol is toxic as well. We all know that. We've all had alcohol poisoning.
Oh, wait, yeah.
The number one ingredient in these cocktails.
Yeah, so for the question of which is more toxic.
Of the two cocktails. Well, I think, listening to what you said about cinnamon being rat poison, and also looking at the cinnamon challenge and how hard it is to eat a whole tablespoon of cinnamon, I reckon your body is doing quite a good job of saying, this shouldn't go in your mouth.
Yeah.
Spit it out. So I think combined with the rhubarb bitters and the cinnamon, I reckon the second cocktail has a greater toxicity than the first.
I think you're onto a winner, yes. But the real reason why it's more toxic is because it's got more alcohol in it. The most toxic thing out of all these things, rhubarb, pineapple, cinnamon, grapefruit juice, alcohol is just a massively toxic thing that we readily consume on a near daily basis. It's quite a bizarre activity. I think if aliens could see us doing the things that we do to our bodies, they'd find it utterly bizarre.
And vodka has got more alcohol than amaretto.
It does, yeah.
Oh, I didn't realise that. Well, there we go. Cheers.
Nice.
And to celebrate our toxic cocktails, what are you playing us out with?
So I'm now going to play Beverly Kills by Ariel Pink, because he talks about killing the freaks with her poison arrows. No!
Brain cells die within a few minutes of the heart stopping. Skin cells can survive for up to 24 hours.
Good old skin cells.
Living strong. I was really surprised by that. I would have thought your skin cells would need quite a lot of oxygen and stuff.
Well, they normally get a lot of their oxygen just like cells on the surface of your skin get oxygen that's just diffusing, like small amount diffusing through the skin.
Oh.
Like not not enough to really keep them going and keep them healthy, but
enough to outlive the brain.
Yeah.
So this leads us really nicely into our next kind of question, which is what happens to you after you've died? We've talked about what is death, but now what happens next? What happens to our bodies when we've taken our last breath?
So the way to explore this, I suppose, is to assume that after you've died, you've been left in the woods somewhere, because generally what happens to most people, hopefully, is that they're taken to a crematorium or they're buried. But to look at what happens to bodies if they're just left out in the elements, what happens to them then? So there's five distinct stages of decomposition that happens to cadavers.
Which is the official term for a dead body.
Yes. So a lot of this stuff that I've found out about was through working with Dr. Anna Williams from the University of Huddersfield. So she's a taphonomist who studies how bodies decay. So the first stage, so the fresh stage, as it's called. So we've covered a bit of what happens during that, like with rigor mortis and stuff, over the first 24 hours. After that, what starts to happen is a stage called the bloat stage. So this is when all of the friendly bacteria, Yakult fans, that have been helping you throughout your life, helping you to digest things.
Yeah, the gut, the microbes in your gut.
Yeah, your microbiome starts to turn on you.
And really?
Like once your immune system isn't keeping you safe, all of these bacteria in your gut start to...
They seize the moment, seize the opportunity.
Yeah, and start to eat you. And of the things that these bacteria are really, really good at doing is pumping out loads of waste gas. So your body starts to swell up like a big balloon because like the gas can't get out. And when it does start to come out, it comes out of all the orifices that you might expect. So yeah, the body becomes quite sort of inflated, and it can mean that sometimes bodies are incorrectly identified as having drowned because they look
so bloated.
Yeah. Also, one of the things that happens during that stage is this sort of weird marbling effect of the skin. So the skin will kind of go like a
like a kind of greyish, bluish colour, right?
Yeah. Look a bit like a piece of Stilton. And that's because your hemoglobin starts to bind with sulfur because it can't bind, there's no oxygen left in
it. And just for anyone that doesn't know what hemoglobin is, that's the molecule in your red blood cells that binds to oxygen.
Yeah. So
it's binding to sulfur instead.
Starts to bind to sulfur, and that starts to get pushed through your capillary network by all this sort of gas that's sort of filling up inside you. You then move on to the active stage.
And sorry, just to clarify, so when it binds to sulfur, it doesn't turn red.
No, it turns a sort of greeny-blue colour, I guess.
That's so interesting.
Yeah, pretty grim. So then you get the active stage. That's when you'll start to get things like flies' eggs laid inside you, and maggots will start to eat away.
Yeah, because maggots are fly larvae, aren't they?
Yeah.
I heard they go through like three stages of molting and growth before they then turn into a fly.
Oh.
So you can have first, second or third stage maggots, and that's another way of like telling how dead the body is.
Yeah. And like taphonomists will use insects as like one of their main sort of indicators for how long you've been left in the woods. So yeah, this active stage gets a name active because like the body can become this sort of writhing mass of life almost, because that so many things start to live off it. And also at that stage, a lot of this gas that's built up during the bloat stage will get released because you'll burst open.
They're starting to bite into you and let out.
Yeah.
I'm guessing that's the stuff that smells really bad.
Yeah, so the stinkiest stage is definitely the active stage. Then once the maggots have had their way with you, you probably even get like larger things like, I don't know, crows, vultures, foxes having a go at you as well. But then you go into the advanced stage. So this is where a lot of the damage that happens to the cadaver just happens through weathering. So rain, wind, and like you gradually get moved on to the skeletonization stage, where what tissues are left on your body, so like any skin or tendons, would just start to get eaten by mosses, fungi, plants even, and all that's left of you are your skeletal remains, which can be preserved. Like, bones can last for like hundreds of years.
So. Just too hard for other things to break down.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow. I found out that for every kilogram of dry body mass, like, that you have, so 50 to 75% of your body is water. So if you weigh like 50 kilos, then maybe only 25 of that will be dry body mass.
Yeah.
But every kilo of those 25 will release 32 grams of nitrogen, 10 grams of phosphorus, 4 grams of potassium, and 1 of magnesium into the soil. There's like so many cool minerals in our body that are just going into the soil when we decompose.
Circle of life.
And that particularly smelly stage of decomposition, you've actually done an Art Necro event about it, haven't you?
Yeah, so Dr. Anna Williams, who I mentioned, we worked together on sort of trying to recreate these five stages through the different chemicals that are expunged by the body at them. So Anna does a lot of research on measuring what chemicals you get at each stage, and you can identify how decomposed they are by these chemicals. And in fact, recreating these smells is a really important process in trying to train cadaver dogs. So these are the dogs that, when they're looking for a body, they'll send out into the woods. But depending on whether you are fresh, bloated, active, advanced, or skeletonized, they need to use a different dog.
Oh, wow. So if they think, oh, she disappeared a month ago, they'll use a different dog than if you only disappeared a week ago.
Exactly, yeah.
Because your body's going to smell different.
But at the moment, it's kind of hard to train these dogs because we don't have what are known as body farms in the UK or even in Europe. So
where do you have body farms?
So there are close to a dozen all across the US.
What happens at a body farm?
So a body farm is basically like a giant field laboratory where they take bodies and they will leave them out in different environments and sort of look at what happens to those bodies over a course of
weeks,
months.
Way of studying them.
Yeah, and these are a really important way of helping sort of get more information on what happens to bodies after they die. But yeah, we don't have any facilities for them in the UK or Europe, in fact.
So Dr. Anna Williams is recreating these smells to train the dogs.
Yeah, so she's having to take a more of a sort of chemistry approach to doing it. So she analyses the chemicals at the different stages, isolates all the different ones, and then tries to sort of put them back together. So there's lots of things like fatty acids, things like butyric acid or 2-methyl butyric acid, lots of amine groups, which smell quite fishy.
Ooh.
Trimethyl amine, I think it's called, is particularly disgusting. You get something called indole, which is found in everything from poo to chocolate, semen to coffee. So it's,
oh wow, so that one gets around.
Yeah, it really
I don't think any of those things smell the same.
No, well, a lot of what something smells like is kind of controlled by the concentration of it as much as what the chemical is itself. So yeah, I think you also get indole in jasmine flowers, so yeah, but it's a much lower concentration in those than
right.
Something like poo has got absolutely loads of indole in it. And then you've also got things like you've got hexanal and butanal, which you get more of those in the later skeletonization phases, and they're more sort of earthy, planty smells. So they smell, hexanal smells like freshly cut grass, butanal smells like kind of rotting wood. So
that's quite nice.
Yeah, they're quite pleasant.
Oh, I wouldn't mind the skeletonized body.
Yeah,
that can stay. And so if that's what happens to the body, what is happening to the brain? Because there are all these folklore, like you were saying at the beginning, of, you know, almost all religions have an idea of life after death. You've got stories of so many people across the whole world talking about seeing a light or speaking to a being or having this out-of-body experience. And these are people who've then been revived. And the fact that they've all had such similar experiences is really interesting. We call them kind of near-death experiences. And there's actually been a big kind of scientific study looking at people brought back after cardiac arrest. And 18% of the people brought back described having a near-death experience and could often say what was going on in the room around them, like, accurately, but they were dead. And, like, what is going on here?
Yeah, so near-death experiences are pretty fascinating because there does seem to be some amount of shared experience within them, even though it's obviously quite an individual thing, and it's a hard thing. You can't really try and orchestrate it in a lab. You just have to let these things happen naturally and then get people's reports from them. One of the theories that's knocking about that I find really interesting is the link between near-death experiences and a particular type of hallucinogen called DMT. So DMT, or to give it its full name, N,N-dimethyltryptamine, is this chemical which is thought to be released by a gland in the centre of the brain called the pineal gland. And it's thought to be linked to dreaming or like certain conscious states.
So do we release it like when we're alive as well?
Yeah, well, it's hard to measure because it's in this gland right in the centre of the brain. Yeah. So
I guess ethically it's quite hard to do experiments on
yeah,
stuff.
Yeah, although we can do a lot of really cool stuff looking at what's going on in the brain electrically with MRI. Like, it's harder to do hormonal stuff, look at what things are being released in the centre. But yeah, there's this really nice theory that when we die, the pineal gland sort of like goes into atrophy, or it relaxes, and it releases this sort of last
store of DMT.
Yeah, this sort of swan song of DMT washes over your brain, and you have this very intense hallucination, basically. And people take DMT recreationally. They all, although they're quite bizarre, random experiences, they all tend to have a very similar experience. So it has comparisons to these near-death experiences in a way that, although people all experience very sort of different things in life, they all sort of come together and experience the same thing here. Although there's not much evidence out there to prove it, because it's a difficult thing to try and prove, I like it. It's a good theory.
Yeah, and I guess it's kind of like nice to think that you go out with a bit of a bang. Like,
yeah, like you're sort of, your last hurrah is like taking a really extreme hallucinogen. Like, something to look forward to. And, you know, maybe in that sort of split second, or however long it is, just before your brain completely switches off, maybe, yeah, you are experiencing, like, well, you know,
you have a kind of profound,
either a good trip or a bad trip.
Yeah.
So, yeah, maybe there is a kind of heaven or hell
in that final moment.
Terms. Yeah.
Oh, that's so interesting.
Yeah, I like that one.
The only other theory that I'd seen was from the University of Kentucky, saying that they think it might be caused by a sleep disorder of rapid eye movement. Yeah. So we get that every time when we go to sleep, rapid eye movement is a stage of sleep where you do all your dreaming. And the reason they think this could be possible is that it occurs in the brain stem, which is like the lowest part of your brain, the most primitive, and the last part to die. So when people are technically brain dead, their brain stem might not be dead yet. But then it's been criticized by saying, but surely you need the higher brain to interpret it. So it's just a theory as well. But yeah, another one floating around.
Nice.
But the DMT one is cooler. And to celebrate it, I believe we have a DMT song to play.
Called DMT Song by Flying Lotus featuring Thundercat.
Fingernails and toenails do not continue to grow after death. The skin dries and contracts around them, making it look as though they have grown.
News just in. Robot with a mouth and stomach can forage for food and create its own energy.
Dinosaur brain tissue discovered for first time in 130 million year old fossil.
Vaping links to a whole host of new health risks.
The male contraceptive jab is almost as effective as the female pill, but has nasty side effects.
Restorers lift the lid on Jesus' tomb in Jerusalem.
Science exonerates HIV's patient zero.
Oh my god, yeah, vaping has health risks. I watched a whole Horizon on this where Michael Moseley investigates it and concludes that actually, like, he vapes himself for a month and stuff and then goes to all these labs and he concludes that it's pretty safe.
Yeah, well, I think what it is quite good for is giving up tobacco products, which it has a lot to say for doing that. But according to a new study, they sort of scraped out nasal cells and compared them with those of smokers, those of non-smokers and those of vapers. And they sort of assessed the genes for problems with immunity. The vapors had the worst problems with immunity in their nasal cells. These genes were not functioning normally.
So they think
I'm one of those idiots.
You're a vapor.
I'm sorry. Yeah, I was. It's the thing. Was the article about popcorn lung?
No, it wasn't about popcorn. I watched popcorn lung.
So I have a vested interest in this because I'm an idiot vapor. I'm that guy, I'm sorry. But yeah, I'm constantly trying to find out, is this actually safer for me than smoking? And the thing that I stumbled across the other day was popcorn lung. It sounds like...
sounds fun.
Yeah, it's the most fun form of emphysema going. And the only thing that they've got to compare it to is people who worked in a popcorn factory in the States who were breathing in sort of oil and vegetable oil vapors, which is basically what vaping is, ended up getting this condition known as popcorn lung because at the moment the studies only go back like 5 years because it's not been around long enough. So there's no longitudinal data on what it's doing to people apart from these poor popcorn factory workers.
Does it worry you enough to make you quit?
Well, it's got to be better than actual smoking.
Yeah, that's the thing. I think it is.
That is true.
And so don't start if they're not already doing it, but it's fine if it's stopping you from actual smoking.
When you see like children vaping, it's like,
a 12-year-old on a crowded train and he was wearing a full Boy Scout uniform and then he just did a massive like...
And yet you didn't say hello.
Big old vape.
So the story that really caught my attention was this robot with the mouth and the stomach. It's so cool. It's based on a sea animal called a salp, which is just like a tube. It takes in food at one end and waste at the other. And as this robot sucks in a belly full of water with biomatter, it then has this microbial fusel gut, so essentially a gut full of microbes, and they break down the biomass in the water and convert the chemical energy in the biomass into electrical energy, which keeps the robot powered. So it's like a self-sustaining robot. And okay, at the moment, it's just a proof of concept. The water has been like optimized with lots of biomatter for it.
But they're cheating.
They're hoping one day to obviously improve it. And then if you've had like a toxic spill or loads of pollution in your ocean, you could just let this robot free and it would go and clear it all up.
I can't see anything possibly going wrong with that. More robots now, please.
True. Yeah. Well, unfortunately, we don't have that much time for science news today. But excitingly, 3 Minute Science is back. And this week we have Dean talking to Kyle. And he's actually going to be doing a talk tomorrow at the London Wetland Centre. So check out his 3 Minute Science. And if it inspires you, go and have a listen.
3 Minute Science.
3 Minute Science.
So I'm Dean Lomax, a paleontologist and an honorary scientist at the University of Manchester, and I travel the world looking at fossils. A lot of my work actually focuses on looking at specimens already discovered in museums and somewhat rediscovering fossils hidden away in museum collections.
So do you focus specifically on one time or one animal?
But I've become somewhat a specialist now in ichthyosaurs, specifically early Jurassic ichthyosaurs. And ichthyosaurs are extinct marine reptiles. So these were sort of dolphin-shaped reptiles that swam in the oceans whilst the dinosaurs walked on land. And specifically, I work on the early Jurassic material of a particular species, a particular genus called Ichthyosaurus, which is found primarily in the UK, but is also found elsewhere in Europe and in North America.
What is it that got you interested in specifically ichthyosaurs?
They are my specialism, and I find them quite fascinating creatures, especially the fact that they are what we would call a great example of convergent evolution, which is a process whereby ichthyosaurs had evolved this body plan, which now today we can compare with sharks and compare to dolphins, and yet ichthyosaurs were reptiles, dolphins are mammals, and of course sharks are fish, and yet they all share this similar body plan. I think that's quite fantastic, quite interesting, looking at convergent evolution. Ichthyosaurs are so cool. I mean, they first evolved around 248 million years ago. They went, that which was before the first dinosaurs evolved. They became extinct about 90 million years ago before the non-bird dinosaurs went extinct at the end of the Cretaceous. And they ranged in size from about 1 meter in length through upwards of over 15 meters. So they were very interesting beasts.
We're going through something of a mass extinction event at the moment. Is that something that can be prevented, or?
I think to some extent it's inevitable. If, as a paleontologist, you look at the fossil record and you can see there are big major extinction events that have happened throughout the history of life. And lots of minor extinction events have happened as well. Minor extinction events are still mega. They're still on a huge global scale where perhaps, say, 10% of life has been wiped out, or up to 70 or even almost up to 90% of life in some cases. So it's I think personally it is inevitable that there will be some other forms of extinction. The rate of extinction of certain groups of animals certainly isn't helped by humans. I mean, you'll see, for example, very recently there was a species of rhino that was wiped out and completely extinct. You know, it's an interesting thing to think about.
3 minute science.
3 minute science.
And if you enjoyed hearing about what Dean does, you can hear more tomorrow.
This weekend, there is a Dinosaur Days event at Barnes, just on the outskirts of London, at the London Wetlands Centre. And I'm going to be there on Sunday morning at 10 a.m. talking about British dinosaurs. So if anybody would like to come along, please pop on by and see that.
3 minute science.
And on to our next song. What is it going to be?
Our next song is by The Zombies, and it is This Will Be Our Year.
I think no extra exclamation needed for that one.
I'm your love like the warmth from the sun, and this will be our year, took a long time to come. Don't let go of my hand, now the darkness has gone. This will be our year, took a long time to come. And I won't forget the way you helped me up when I was down. And I won't forget the way you said, darling, I love you. You gave me faith to go on. Now we're there and we've only just begun. This will be our year, took a long time to come.
There are animals that don't die, or at least don't die from old age. These include jellyfish and a kind of flatworm.
Yeah, it's so cool. Biological immortality. Cheating death the biological way.
Jellyfish are going to take over the world, you know.
Oh, I hate them.
Yeah.
I really hope not.
They get spread around by big freighters. They'll rule us all one day.
Okay, well, from jellyfish to another terrifying potential infestation of zombies.
Yes.
Right, The Living Dead. They feature in so many scary films.
Yep.
They always come out at Halloween. But what is the scientific basis for zombies?
There's a few fairly tenuous examples of like zombies happening naturally. But like, so one of them is the Ophiocordyceps unilateralis, which is a fungus that infects the brains of ants and makes them sort of climb up the tree to a place where the fungus will be in a nice sort of moist, warm environment where it can spread all of its spores. So it kind of uses the ant as a vehicle to get itself to a more beneficial place.
Oh, because fungi can't move.
They don't have legs. They struggle to get around at speed.
And there's quite a few examples of this, of like a kind of parasite, a virus or a fungus or something living or using another animal for its own aims.
Yeah, I mean, it sort of depends like how you define what its aims are, but there's certainly a lot of parasites that modify the behavior and activity of their host. So another one is Toxoplasma gondii. Now this is a parasite, a protozoa, that 30% of the population carry. I think it's about 50% in France.
Of the human population?
Of the human population.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. It's thought to be largely benign, like it doesn't really do anything. But when they have taken blood samples from people who've died in freak car accidents, so people who've, like, you know, pulled over from one side of the road, like, into oncoming traffic, they find that they have a statistically higher chance of having this Toxoplasma gondii. So there's a
road rage might be connected to a parasite.
Yeah, yeah. There's a thought that, like, impulsive behaviour might be brought on by having this parasite.
That's so interesting.
But because it doesn't have any
physical symptoms, obvious symptoms.
Yeah, normal symptoms that, like, you know, someone's just a bit grumpy, like, they don't have to go to the doctors. Yeah, there hasn't been a huge amount of work to find out what it's actually doing.
So half of France.
Yeah.
So, road rage.
Like, that's what I like most. That,
the French more, always are grumpy.
More common in French people. it's more common in cat owners as well.
So. Yeah, because this particular cell has to complete its life cycle inside a cat.
Yeah, yeah. It's like sort of the equivalent of Alien, like the sort of chest burster, face hugger, sort of, like, but it has to go into cat form at some point.
Because I didn't know it could be in humans, but I had heard that it's often in rats, and it makes the rats easier for cats to catch because the cell wants to be in the cat. So, and similarly, like, there's some fish where they have worms in their brain, and the more worms in the brain, the more they exhibit behaviours which make them easier for the birds to catch, like swimming near the surface.
Yeah, just makes them stupid.
Yeah. I think the one that's, for me, most like 28 days later or something like that is the rabies virus.
Yeah, well, that makes you hydrophobic, doesn't it? Like, so you become scared of water, like scared of having a wash, you know. and yeah, that makes you quite aggressive again.
Foaming at the mouth.
I mean, it makes animals more likely to sort of bite you because it makes them more aggressive. So yeah, in that respect, it's a really effective way of spreading the disease onto another organism.
So, not quite Hollywood style yet, but no. We do have, there is a basis.
A happy note to end on, eh?
And it's time to reveal the answer to our brain teaser. So, Yaz, have we had any guesses?
So, yeah, the brain teaser was, I have no life, but I can die. What am I?
Mm-hmm.
And Mark Webster, I can kind of see where he was going with this. He says, if you're at home with no booze, but there's also a power cut. So I guess he's thinking of some sort of
dying
sad
of despair.
Accidental death. but I don't think that's the answer. So anyone else?
Is it a Yahtzee set? It has a die. What I can has die.
No, that's almost too clever.
No, don't know. Not smart business. Not sure.
I'm going to reveal. A battery.
Good
that
one.
Was just the reaction I was going for. And finally, all I have left to say is thank you so much for joining us today on our spooky show.
Super spooky. Spooky action at a distance.
And what song are you going to play us out with?
So I'm going to finish with Glad to Know You by Kitty Grant, because it's a really nice song about, you can either see it as like death or like the end of things, but it's an awesome tune. Top tune.
Soho Radio.
Soho Radio.
Soho Radio.
Soho Radio.